Good. The last latecomers are drifting in, but we will get started anyway. Good morning, everybody. I hope you slept well. I gather that there are some people who maybe didn't get quite enough sleep because they were staying late in the bar last night. I'm glad to see that they're here already, the others who are late. We've got three sessions this morning, very much on the practicalities of studying the Bible, applying it, and how to teach it in a small group. This first session is all about how to study a passage for ourselves. Let me begin with a few minutes just motivating us to do that, because studying the Bible is not easy. You've probably discovered that already. And it can be quite tempting to say, actually, why bother? The slob study tells me the answers. My job is simply to communicate that to my group. Studying the Bible is a luxury which maybe is for other people, not for me. Three reasons, I think, why it's important for us to study the Bible for ourselves and not simply be content with transmitting the answers from our slob group to our groups. The first is that the country badly needs people who know how to study the Bible for themselves. Not just the country, the world. So one of our goals in Read, Mark, Learn is not simply to teach the content of what God is saying in his word, but also to teach people how to study the word for themselves. If you like, we see one of the ways in which we serve the wider church as sending out people who are equipped in studying the Bible and in teaching the Bible to be able to serve churches up and down the country and around the world. Just the nature of St. Helens is very few people stay at St. Helens for more than 6 or 7 years at most. Most people only about 3 or 4. The chances, therefore, are that in 5 or 6 years at most, you will be in another church, probably a much smaller church, a church without the resources that we are fortunate enough to have at St. Helens, a church where you won't have a slob group to teach you the answers, a church where you will almost certainly, if you're leading in this sort of setting, be asked to lead in that sort of setting, but you won't be given the help, support, and backup that you're being given here. And if you don't know how to study the Bible at that point, you'll be a bit stuffed. Books are actually not that much help. Most commentaries, if you look at them, don't actually give you much help in understanding the overall point of a passage. They're quite good on the detail, but not very good at the big things that you need if you're going to study and to teach the Bible in a group setting. Study guides are no better. The second reason, so that's one reason why I think we want you not just to transmit information we give you, but be able to study the Bible for yourself so that you can know how to handle it, whether you've got the backup of a slob group or not. The second reason why it's important that you know how to study the Bible for yourself is that, believe it or not, we do not have all the answers in St. Helens to what Mark, Romans, and the Bible Overview are all about. Good afternoon, Gwilym. We don't have the answers in St. Helens to what all these books are all about. What we're teaching is where we've got to so far. We won't actually grow in our understanding of those books unless we all work at it corporately together and year on year improve our understanding. So all that I was telling you yesterday from Romans, I passed off as though I'd worked it out for myself. Actually, I'd shamelessly plagiarized lots of it from leaders in previous years, pinching each year the best ideas to be incorporated into the next year's Romans presentation and slob studies and super slob studies and everything else. So as you study the Bible and work hard at it and chip in your contributions in slob studies, you're actually, though you may not be aware of it, contributing to the overall corporate effort at St. Helens to understand books like Romans better. The third reason why it's important for us to study the Bible for ourselves and not just transmit information is that actually one of the greatest joys in Bible study is hearing God speak for yourself. It's much more exciting to see from God's word a truth leap off the page and hit you than just to have somebody tell you the answer in a sermon or a Bible study, for those of you who have studied the Bible and the penny has dropped and you thought, yes, that is what it is, isn't it? You will know what I mean when you say this. There's just the excitement of hearing God speak. And it'd be a shame if you were deprived of that excitement, that joy. So what are we aiming to do as we study the Bible for ourselves? The first thing we're aiming to do is to hear God speak in His Word, to grasp and then to respond to what God intends to say as He wrote His Word. That actually is the purpose of all communication. So when we said to you in the letter that we sent out, there is an RML Leaders Training Weekend on the weekend of whatever it is, the 22nd to 24th of September in Harbin House. We'd like you to attend. We meant just that. There is a weekend. There has been. There is currently a weekend here at Harbin House, and we did want you to attend. So we're very glad you're here. And for those listening on tape, we wish you were here. You weren't at liberty to interpret that in a way that suited you, sort of, oh, I can't make the weekend of the 22nd to 24th. I'll just pretend that they'd said it was the weekend of the 29th to the 30th instead, and I'll turn up to that weekend. It wouldn't have worked. There wouldn't have been a training weekend here had you turned up next week. Similarly, you weren't at liberty to say, ah, yes, I note that there is a training weekend, but no, I don't think I'll bother. We were trying to communicate something to you, which was the fact that there's an event here, and we were trying to elicit from you a response, which is your attendance here. Now, that is a baby example of communication at work, but that is exactly what God is doing in speaking to us in His Word. He's trying to communicate something, a truth that He intends to us, that He wants us to respond to in a way that He, if you like, wishes. Now, for those of you who've come across something called postmodernism, let me just say a few words about that. Postmodernism is a trend, a phase, a fad in modern scholarship, which is becoming immensely powerful. You may be aware of it. You may have been influenced by it without being aware of it. Or, if neither of those is the case, the people you teach in your group may be being influenced by it. So it's just worth being aware that postmodernism says it's impossible to understand what an author is communicating. You may say how ridiculous, but a very large proportion of the academic community is going down this line at the present moment. And therefore, if it's impossible to understand what an author is communicating, it's impossible to work out what God is saying in His Word. You can see the problems. However, I think that postmodernism is misconceived and misguided. All that postmodernism actually proves is that it is impossible to understand an author absolutely perfectly. They work on the very silly assumption that if you can't understand an author absolutely perfectly, you can't understand an author at all, which is clearly ridiculous. And in all normal communication, we say, I may not be able to understand what you're saying perfectly, but I understand what you're saying completely adequately for the purposes that you intended. And so it is with God. We may not understand every single nuance of what God is saying. In fact, it'll take us all eternity to, because it's so rich and there's so much there. But that doesn't mean we can't understand it truly and adequately, usefully. And that's even more the case because the person communicating with us in this situation is not a human author, but a divine author who wrote exactly what he knew would work and who has given us his Holy Spirit to help us understand and interpret it. So I do want to say very strongly that we can understand what God says. And if you've been brought up to think we can't, come and chat to me. If people in your group say they can't, just be aware this is a fad and a phase, come to chat to somebody like myself if issues arise. There is an implication to saying that in the Bible, God is speaking and intends us to understand his meaning. And that implication is that there is only one meaning to a passage. And it's at that point that many of you may be influenced by postmodernism, whether you realize it or not. That a lot of people, when they study the Bible, want to say, well, it means this to me, and it may mean that to you, and that's quite all right. And I think I want to say that is not the case. If God is communicating something and intends that communication, then he wants the same thing to be heard by all of us. So when we said to you, again, let's go back to our baby example. When we said to you, there is a training weekend at Harpen House on the 22nd to the 24th, you couldn't say, well, it means that for me, but it doesn't mean that for John over there. We meant that for all the leaders, without exception. And the same is true of God's communication to us. If we don't understand the one meaning that God intended in his word, we have missed what God is saying. Now, let me put a couple of caveats in right away to try to quell some of the twitching that I suspect is happening around the room. I am not saying that there's only one layer of meaning. So there may be one meaning, but there's all sorts of nuances and depths to that, which as we study the Bible more and more, we may delve into and dig out, all well and good. But the different meanings won't contradict or be different from the one meaning God intends. It's just be understanding it in more depth. Secondly, we're not saying that we have ever fully discovered what God is saying, or even that it's possible to. We're simply saying there is one truth that God is communicating. Let me draw that as a diagram, if I don't pull this off, which might make sense. If we represent, this pen doesn't work very well, does it? Let's try red. If we say, I represent God's truth by this line, all we're saying is that as you read the Bible, be aware that there is something it's trying to teach, an absolute line, an absolute level. Our understanding may never reach there. Our understanding may do something like that. So with the passage of time and work, with the passage of time and work, we may move up this curve, getting closer and closer to God's truth, but never actually reaching it. For the mathematicians amongst us, we approach it asymptotically. But we never actually reach God's truth. So we're not saying we've reached the truth. We're not arrogantly saying, I've got nothing to learn. I have the answer. Listen to me. I've got God's truth. No, we're not saying that. What we're saying is that in the Bible, God's truth exists. And as we work at it, and over the months and years and decades, we will come closer and closer to it. But there's always more learning to be done, always more understanding to be done, which is wonderful because it means that as long as you started doing some work and you're on that, you're getting some of God's truth. But there's always motivation to do more. So if you've done Romans last year, there's still a lot more truth in God's word in Romans for you to understand as you work at it this year and go a bit further up the curve. And next year, and next year, and next year. And I can say from personal experience that this is, I think this is the start of my 8th year in Romans, leading Romans. And I'm still learning new things from it. And I'm sure that that will continue for as long as I'm alive. So there is a lot more understanding to come, but there is an absolute meaning in the text. I ought to have taken that off by this stage and said, so there we are. So we don't have all the answers. But there is only one meaning. There are three things that we need to do if we're going to hear what God is saying in the text and work out what he intends to communicate. The first is pray. God wrote it in order that we might understand it, but we do need his help to understand it. It's not something we can get just by dint of being clever. The world is full of non-Christian liberal theologians who have totally missed the point of what God's saying in his word, even though they're working very hard at it. So pray. We need God's help. Secondly, work hard at it. God wrote it to be understood, but not without hard work. I strongly suggest that you need to do at least 3 to 4 hours work on the text before the slob study. You may need to do a little bit of work after the slob study to turn your understanding into a study, but just at the level of understanding the passage, aim to spend, budget to spend 3 to 4 hours a week on that. And thirdly, we need to work to handle the text correctly. And that's the one I want to focus on now. Let me give us 4 guidelines to how we work out what the text is saying. The first is we need to work out the human author's intention in writing. Okay? Let me try to unpack that. I said that God is trying to communicate to us through his word. But God chose to work through his human servants. He chose to work through his apostles and his prophets. He chose to work not just through his apostles and prophets, but he chose to work by them writing books, letters, gospels into a specific historical situation. God could have bypassed them. God could have written his truth in letters in the sky. God could have written what he wanted to say in tablets of stone. In fact, he did it once. He could have done it for all of what he said. But he only did it on that one occasion for the Ten Commandments. Most of what God has communicated to us, he's communicated by human authors writing letters of books into specific historical situations. God sovereignly overruled to make sure that those human authors were writing exactly what he wanted, but he works through them, not despite them. So understanding God's purpose involves grasping what the human authors wanted to say. So let me say that again. Grasping what God is trying to say to us involves understanding what the human authors are trying to say, because he's working through them. And that is a much easier task, because in everything we do, whenever we read a newspaper article, instructions on getting to RML weekends, we're engaged in the exercise of understanding what a human author intends. So we're used to doing that. It's something we know how to do. Let me just draw it up as a diagram, which might help all of us. Sorry, let me just fiddle with this bit of paper, which doesn't want to separate. If at the start of the process you get God, and at the end of the process you get us, some people would want to argue that God communicates to us directly. And we're saying, no, that is not the way God speaks. He doesn't speak just in timeless principles written in the sky or in our experience or in dreams in the middle of the night. That is not the way that God normally speaks. We're not saying he can't. He has in the past, in various times. But by and large today, now that Jesus has come and the canon is closed, God does not normally speak that way. Rather, he normally speaks to a human author writing into a historical situation to us.
Michael, what do you mean the canon is closed?
Sorry. Now that Jesus has come, God has finished revealing what he wants to reveal, and we don't add extra books to the Bible. So we have the Bible. It's got a back cover. Revelation is the last book in the Bible. God has basically finished revealing about himself and what he's doing. Everything that is necessary is now done, and the only event we're now waiting for is Jesus' return, by which stage it'll be too late to add anything to the Bible. let me just say a few more things, and then I will pause and take questions. What we're saying on this is, as I say, we're saying it's illegitimate to say God speaks directly to us. God works to his authors, to the historical situation, to us. The fact that God works through his human authors, and we have to go that way, is the reason why we study the Bible rather than sitting in darkened rooms waiting for inspiration to strike or going to bed with having had lots of cheese hoping for a dream. We study the Bible because God speaks to us in his human author. But that isn't the end of the story. So some people would want to say we go straight from what the human author says to us. And again, that is illegitimate. Those human authors were writing into historical situations. And we need to say, what did that human author, Paul in this case, intend to say as he wrote to that historical situation, which was Rome around AD 58, 60, somewhere around there. If we come straight to us, if we try to go from Paul straight to us, then we will misunderstand the text in all sorts of ways. Let me give you an example. In the book of Romans, Paul talks a lot about there's neither Jew nor Gentile. The Jew first, and also to the Gentile, they're in the same boat. Now, the Jew-Gentile issue is not a big issue in the 21st century in England. And for most people who try to go straight from Paul to us, what they do is they say, whenever we talk about the Jew-Gentile issue, all we mean is any racial divide. It would be exactly the same principle if you're talking about black and white in pre-apartheid South Africa or Southern North America, or any other religious divide. That's all that Paul is talking about. But it isn't that at all. The Jew-Gentile divide was a very specific issue where God was speaking to say that the Jews, who were his historical people, actually aren't saved any differently to the rest of the world. There is no equivalent parallel to that in black or white, brown or yellow, or any other skin color. But you only understand that when you take Paul writing into first century Rome, not when you try to go from Paul to 21st century London. So as we try to work out Bible study, as we study the Bible, we have to say the fact that God speaks through his human authors is why we study at all. Working out what the human authors were saying to the historical situation is, if you like, working out Paul's intention for his first century authors. And that's the first big thing we need to do. But then after that, we need to say, so if that's what Paul intended for there, what are the implications for us? So if I miss that step out, I miss out using scripture at all. If I miss that step out, I miss taking what the author said seriously and understanding scripture correctly. And if I miss that step out, I lose any application for myself. It just remains an academic exercise. A historian studies Paul to see what was said into the first century, but it has no relevance to me today in the 21st century. So can you see how each of those three steps is absolutely crucial? We don't have to do much with that. We just have to acknowledge it has happened. God has spoken through Paul, and therefore we study Paul. We don't need to work out how God spoke to Paul. None of our business. He did. But that's why we study the Bible. That's the one we have to do the work on, and that. That is relatively easy in the case of Rome, because Rome is in the same position as we are after Jesus. Harder if you're looking at what happens in the Old Testament, but quite easy in the New, but still needs to be done. That is the one which is our immediate challenge for this moment. Let me take any questions up to this point. Now, anyone else have a question? Does that make sense? Everybody awake? No? Good. Anybody in the back row awake? Good. Glad to hear that. No question so far. That's all clear. Good. Let's press on then. So how do I work out what we're going to first of all focus on what the human author said into his historical situation, that leg. How do I work out what the human author is saying into his historical situation? How do I work out what Paul is saying to the Romans? And that leads me on to my next two guidelines. The first is that in order to work out what the human author intends in a specific situation, we want to work out the main point that he is making in the passage we're studying. Paul's purpose, every author's purpose, is found in his main point, not buried in the detail. Let me say that again. The author's purpose is found in his main point. It is not found buried in the detail. So again, let me give you an example. A silly example, but I think it makes the point perfectly adequately. When we sent you the brochure inviting you to this weekend, the main purpose of that brochure was to tell you there was a weekend for leaders on these dates. Please be there. Buried in the detail is things like bring your walking shoes if you want to go for a walk, bring your gym kit if you want to use the gym. The main point, or the point of that brochure was not to tell you there is a gym, come and use it. Can you see how the detail exists? It has a part to play, but it is not the point of the communication. The same is true when we study something like Romans. Paul has something he's trying to communicate, and that is the thing we're trying to disentangle. There is a lot of extra detail there, which contributes in some way or other to the main point. The detail is a means to the end. It is ancillary. It is not where we want to focus. We often focus on the detail because it is much more manageable. We focus on the detail because the commentaries we read focus on the detail. We focus on the detail because most of us have been in Bible studies where most of the time is taken up with the detail. But detail is not the way to understand what the author is trying to communicate. If we do, we will miss what God is saying. That sounds obvious, but I've spent, getting on for 20 years sitting in on Read, Mark, Learn studies, and very, very few Read, Mark, Learn studies end understanding the main point of the passage. Most Read, Mark, Learn studies spend virtually all the time looking at the detail, and then they just stop. Some of the better ones, at the end of looking at all the detail, say, now let's move to application. But the big key point of trying to pull together that detail to say, so what conclusion have we reached? What is Paul actually saying in this passage? Is lamentably absent. In which case, we've just missed what Paul is saying in the passage. So do, as you try to study the Bible and teach it, do try to work out, so what with all that information and data that I have gathered? I've done a lot of hard work. I have mined the text and I've understood the detail. So what? How does it all fit together? It's slightly like if you were going prospecting for gold. You know, you do a lot of hard work trying to work out where in the world you might find gold. You go there and you dig frantically until you find somewhere where there is gold. Then you do even more hard work digging it all out of the ground, big lumps of rock and dirt, and you pound it up and you grind it and you sift it, and then you walk away. And all that work's just gone to waste. What you need at that point is to take all the dust you've got, which is gold, and sort of turn it into an ingot and walk it into the bank. Only at that point has it actually got any cash value. But we are like people who do all the hard graft, but we don't actually do the bit at the end, which means it actually results in value as we hear what God is saying. So that last bit where we pull it together is the important bit. And we need to remember that in our study and in the group studies that we lead. How do we work out the main point of the passage? How do we pull all that detail together to reach a conclusion? Alas, one of the reasons we're bad at it is because it's not that easy. In fact, it's more of an art than a science. I wish I could give you some rules, sort of put the detail into this machine, turn the handle, and out pops Paul's main point. It doesn't work like that. What we need to do is do things like, in each passage, look for the conclusion that Paul is driving at. Look at what seems to be the heart of the passage. See what his argument is, and sort of, as you trace through the steps, that will tell you whether the big thing is the conclusion he's reaching the argument, or the key logic step in the middle, which sort of allows you to go from the beginning to the end. Oh. But it is an art, more than a science, working out in each passage what the main point is. It's very helpful to see the argument running through the passage by dividing up into subsections. But again, the value of that comes not so much in the dividing up, but in giving each subsection a title, which shows what it's saying and how it fits in the overall argument. Just the dividing up is not that much value. It's the using those divisions to try to sum up the argument, which is where the value comes. And when you've understood the main point of the passage, everything in the passage should fit in with that main point. It should all cohere and make sense. Any questions before I go any further? Now, because the glare is coming through the window, I really can't see your hand. So if you've got any questions, speak up. If you haven't got any questions, are we all feeling quite sluggish this morning? Do we need to stand up and touch our toes? Let's stand up and touch our toes. I think it'd be a good idea. Get the blood moving. Right down, right down. Deep breath. Stretch and down. Rob Booth, given the fact you were last, are you not supposed to be up on your feet, touching your toes? Good. Does that make sense now? Any questions? Okay, let's press on.
Michael,
yes?
When you're saying, looking at the conclusion or the argument or the heart, but pulling out the main point, is that something to do at the end?
I think all the way through, really. So the way I would work on a passage is I'd read it quite quickly and see whether the main point jumps out at me. If it does, if something jumps out at you fairly near the beginning, then all you've got at that point is a hypothesis for what the main point is. You then want to reread and look at the passage and do some work, saying, is that actually right? Have I put my finger on the right main point fairly early on in the process? Or was that a bit of a blind alley now that I've started doing the hard work? But more often than not, when I initially read it, nothing particularly strikes me as being the main point, and I need to do some hard graft. But at some point in the process, I need to start saying, okay, enough hard graft on the detail. Let me try again to say what's the main point. And once I've got that, I then again need to test it, because it's still only a hypothesis. But because our instinct is to do all the detail and never get to the main point, conclusion, heart, whatever, I think I would be asking myself that question as early as possible. You never reach the stage that is blindingly obvious. So you're always asking yourself that question whilst you're still thinking, well, I don't know how to get there. And the way you get there is by asking the question and trying to force yourself to reach a conclusion and then testing it. Thank you, that's a helpful question. Any other questions?
Michael, how do you think if we did a commentary
text, would they help with that? The answer is, some commentaries help. Historically, commentaries have gone through the detail and not actually drawn together the main conclusion. So if you're using any of the older commentaries, they in particular will not tell you what the main point of the passage is. They will just give you the conclusion. More recent commentaries produced, say, in the last 25 years or so, will attempt to give you some sort of main point or conclusion to the passage. It may not be the right one. So you may not agree with it, but at least it'll give you a starting point for thinking. The danger with things like commentaries, though, is that once somebody has given you an idea, it's very hard to get it out of your mind. So my recommendation is you do as much work as you can before you look at a commentary. Because otherwise, the commentary will put this idea in your mind, and even if it isn't right, you won't be able to get it out of your mind. And therefore, it'll shape your thinking. Any other questions? Okay, let's move on. The third guideline out of the four for how we work out what the author's intention is we need to work out how the main point of the passage fits into the book as a whole. The authors, let me stop using author and book and start saying Paul and Romans, since that's what we're looking at. Paul was writing one book, Romans. He wasn't writing lots of separate passages. We may be studying it in 27 passages or thereabouts, because that's we can manage. He didn't write it like that. He wrote one book. And he intends his book to be understood as a whole. And we can only understand each passage in the book as we put it in the context of the book as a whole, not as we look at it in isolation. So if you think about what we did yesterday when we looked at Romans yesterday morning, I hope you saw how each part of Romans made more sense as you saw it in the flow of an argument as Paul tried to achieve one big end, which was giving us confidence in the gospel. If we'd taken any little bit of it, any section, say we jumped into chapter 4, all about faith is the same now as in the Old Testament, you wouldn't have seen that he's doing that in order to make you excited by the gospel and not derailed as you think God's doing something different. That wouldn't have particularly struck you just from that chapter. It only makes that point as you see what it's doing in the flow of the book as a whole. In other words, Paul's purpose in writing each passage was to develop his overall argument. Let me say that again. Paul, as he writes every bit of Romans, is writing that bit in order to develop his overall argument. So you can only understand the bit you're looking at as you understand how it develops the overall argument. You need to put that main point into the book as a whole. Otherwise, you won't understand it. So our goal, actually, is to end the year with a clear grasp of the main things Paul is communicating in the whole book. And again, very few studies I ever look at, seek to do that as a goal. So I hope that by this stage in our time at St. Helens, we know that it is really important to look at the context. I think most people have now realized that context is very important in Bible study. 99.999 ask a question at the very beginning of the study, which goes along the lines of, so what did we look at last week? Long pause. Somebody says, by looking at their notes, what they did last week. Right, says the leader, let's move on to this week's passage. And this week's passage is never again, last week's passage and the rest of it is never again referred to. We never try to integrate what we've looked at this week with last week. So even though we've said, let's do context, that context has never been used. And if that's the case in the studies, I suspect that's the case in our own personal preparation as well, that we might vaguely recollect what's been said in a previous week, but we never use it to think, so how's the argument in the book developing and growing? But if we don't do that, we won't understand what our passage this week is doing. Does that make sense? Any questions? Okay, if you have no questions for me, I've got one for you. I'd like you to spend about 3 or 4 minutes in pairs working out how a passage fits into the whole book. So turn to your neighbor, threes at most, if there are four of you, split into two pairs and work out how, and talk about how do you work out how a passage fits into the whole book. I mean, you've got 4 minutes. Okay. Thank you. Let's call ourselves to order. What sort of ideas did people come up with? How does one go about working out what the passage is saying? Again, I can't see hands, so just spit up, say something. Yes, if you see a recurring theme, that will tell you that you've obviously got something which is something worth keeping an eye on. The problem is it doesn't actually tell you how it's moved the argument on. It just says it's popped up. So the question still is, how does it actually move the argument on? Anyone? But that's helpful. Thank you, Helen, for getting us started. Any other suggestions? Go on.
Well, so we know that Romans are one of the same kind of things, with no sort of no breaks at all. So there are some sections that we've got as working ideas quite well in the thing, so like halfway from 9 to 11, or the starts of chapter 12. And so kind of if you can work out how it's fitting into the immediate section, then that would be a useful stepping stone for the whole book.
Good. Thank you. That's very helpful. Let me just give you an example of what Gwilym said there. You need to locate yourself in the immediate section. So if you think about the idea of, for instance, Jews and Gentiles, you get Jew-Gentiles. Actually, let me see if I just flip this up. No, I wouldn't bother. You get the idea of Jew-Gentiles in chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, but not in chapters 5 to 8. Then again in chapters 9, chapters 10, chapters 11, not explicitly in 12 and 13, and implicitly in 14 and 15. So the Jew-Gentile issue turns up in about half the book, but not randomly. When, for instance, you're in the section 9 to 11, and the Jew-Gentile issue comes up, it's not enough to say, oh, look, I've come across that idea lots before. It's doing something specific in the 9 to 11 section, which may be different to what it's doing in the 1 to 3 section or the 4 section. And you need to think, what's happening in my section on this theme? Thank you. So, yep, locating yourself in the section is a first, crucial first step. What else?
Just having sort of an idea of the way from which you're going along and seeing how each passage either fits that, builds on it.
Yeah, thank you. So having some idea of the main point of the book and saying, how does the detail, well, not the detail, but how does the main point of this little section contribute to that main point? So, I've given you a theory, a hypothesis for what the main point of the book is all about. It's about making us excited about the gospel, removing objections which might suggest the gospel has failed or is wrong in some way. As you work on a section, think, well, how is this section contributing to that idea? What sort of objection to the gospel is it knocking down? If it isn't knocking down an objection, you need to ask, is my overall hypothesis the right one? It may not be. But if you can see objections being knocked down, that will help you understand how this section is fitting in the overall. Thank you, Rob. That's helpful. Yep. Other ideas?
So just asking what's new, what would we miss if this wasn't here?
That, too, is a brilliant question. Thank you, Wes. What would be missing if this section was not here is a really good question. Let's assume that Paul had not written this section and the book had just jumped to the section. What would we be missing? That's a great test for what this section is doing in the overall, which will help you understand why Paul wrote it, to fill that missing link. Okay? So we don't have much more time, but that gives you some ideas of the sorts of lines to be thinking down. Ask yourself basically the question, why is this here? That's always the question to ask. Why is this here? As you do that, you're asking the question, why is the main point of this passage? Ignore the detail. The detail is secondary. Don't ask the question, what's this little detail doing here? ask the question, as I've begun to work out the main point of my chapter or half chapter, what's that main point doing here? I think we can sum up what we've said so far in three questions, which are those. They're questions which is worth writing on a piece of paper and sticking above your desk where you do all your prep, because they're questions to ask of every passage of the Bible. What is the passage saying? Why is it saying it? And why is it saying it here? Why didn't Paul say it elsewhere in the letter? What's it contributing at this stage in his argument? That makes sense. Any questions? Okay, let's move on. All this helps us grasp Paul's purpose in writing to the Romans, which is key, but we need to do one more thing. So if I've worked out the main point and what it's doing in the overall argument, then I've understood what Paul is saying to the Romans. But I still have that step to go. So how do I make the translation from Rome to me? If we stop in Rome, as I said earlier, it's just an academic exercise. In order to hear what God is saying to us, however, we first need to make sure we're very clear what he said to the Romans. So, bother. Thanks, Caroline, but I can just reach. Thank you. Are we still plugged in? Where's have I pulled the wire out from something?
Yeah.
Thanks. So the first thing we want to do is, if you like, work out what Paul's purpose for them was. Yeah, I forgot how to spell purpose even. So the first step in working out what God is saying to me is to work out what Paul's purpose was for the Romans. The next step is to work out the purpose for us. The purpose for us, particularly in the New Testament, may be identical to the purpose for them. Or it may be slightly different, but it will usually bear a lot of similarities in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, the difference between that and that will be bigger. Fortunately, we're not doing the Old Testament this year. So the challenges when you do the Old Testament of how you move from them to us, we can leave for another occasion. But first of all, work out the purpose for them. If you can write that out in a really clear sentence, that is crucial, and we will move on to make use of that afterwards. The purpose for them, can I just underline this? The purpose for them is not just a summary of what's being said. Okay, a summary which just sort of says what's being said. The key word is purpose. What does Paul want them, what to happen? What does he want to accomplish in the life of the Romans as he wrote it? So it's not enough to say, for instance, in chapters 1 to 3 of Romans, the summary is, we've sinned, God is angry. That's a summary. But what's Paul's purpose in writing that? Why did he want to tell the Romans that we have sinned and God is angry? The Romans were Christians. They didn't need to know it so they'd repent. Why did he tell these Christians that God, that people were sinful and God is angry? So we need to work out the purpose for them. But the key thing we're then trying to do is work out what the purpose is for us. And you can see that if we've worked out why Paul wanted those keen Christians in Rome to understand that people are sinful and God is angry, we've pretty nearly got to why we need to know people are sinful, God is angry. It's not a call on us to repent, so why is it there? We need to work that out. Work it out, write out a really clear purpose statement, because that is what is going to drive our response. The section we're going to look at in half an hour's time, it's going to be, how do we apply? If we're not clear on the purpose for us, what God is saying to us, we won't be able to apply. We can't respond to God correctly if we're not clear what God has first said to us clearly. So that is an absolutely crucial intermediate stage. What is God's purpose for us? And it's well worth, in fact, it's vital, I think, to write it out clearly, your conclusion to that, before you move on to, so what's my response going to be? Let me just conclude by saying that studying the Bible is an art that is learnt best as we do it. So if this all sounds a bit daunting and intimidating, never mind, start studying or keep studying. And as you do it, you will get better at it. But it's not the end of the process. We need to turn to how we should respond after a coffee break. Any immediate questions now? Yes, Ruth.
In some ways, Michael, this all sounds quite difficult.
Mm.
And the kind of God directly to us way seems quite appealing and quite immediate.
Yes.
As we know we're in a relationship with God. I mean, much from across people in our groups, you find it quite hard to get their heads around this being the right way to relate to God, all these steps, as opposed to the direct way. Have you got any advice for how we would show them this is actually the right way to relate to God?
Thank you. That's a very good question. This looks hard. It's God speaking to us directly seems much more immediate. We want to go for that. I think that's exactly right, and I think that's why people do try to go down that route so much, even though I don't think it's right, and I don't think people end up hearing God at all. So how do we show people that this is the right way of doing it? God to Paul, to the historical situation to us. I think the answer is we do that by helping people. The first step we need to see is, The first thing we need to do is to show them that God actually speaks normally through his human servants. And there are passages in the Bible, for instance, the Ephesians 4 passage, which we begin the year with, where Jesus says, or Paul says, that Jesus gave word ministers, gave apostles, prophets, teachers to the church in order to equip the saints, that's us, for the work of ministry. So what, according to the Bible, is God's normal means of equipping saints for ministry? It is via the word ministers, the apostles, the prophets. As you look at places like other passages in the Bible, like Hebrews 1, you see that God speaks to people through the prophets, and now in these last days through his son. That's his normal means of working. So the first thing to establish is that God's normal means of working is via his human agents. So that's the first thing. Once you've established that, you've established that they need to study the Bible at all. But the next tempting step is then to go from the Bible straight to us without going via Rome. And that is a harder one to prove. I think that is best proved by using case studies like the Jew-Gentile issue I gave you earlier, where you can see that if you try to go straight from Paul to us without Rome, you actually end up with the wrong point. So I think that's the best way to do it. At least it's the best way I can think of on my feet at the moment. That's a good question. Gwilym. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I think that's exactly right, isn't it? So as people taste the scriptures, they will see that God is, this really is God speaking. And again, you can see that. I don't know how many of you have had experiences of churches where people have dreams and visions and share them with the congregation. But the ones I've been to have all been very, very banal, sort of, God loves you and he wants good for you. And you sort of think, yes, that's nice. But there's just no substance there. Compared to the Bible, where you discover about the great triune God and his plan for all eternity and what he's done in Jesus and the new creation, that gives you something which you think, this is exciting. This is blowing me away. In the way that some of the slightly bland prophecies and dreams and visions that you hear in some of the more charismatic churches, I don't think do. So yeah, tasting it and seeing just how thrilling the word is, I think it's one of the key ways in which we help people see this really is God speaking. Good. Any other points or questions?
Should we always be encouraging our group to answer for Rome rather than perhaps bringing in stuff that they know from Paul's other people?
Thank you. Yes. Should we always be encouraging people to answer from Romans? Yes. It's not a hard and fast rule. So it's one of those hard questions to answer because at the end of the day, there are benefits sometimes in using what is said in other letters as well. But For given where most of us are in our Bible study, we tend to go to other letters not to help us, but to enable us to get away from the hard work of looking at our passage. It's a cop-out rather than an aid. So I think for most of us in our Bible study and most of us in our groups, we want to say, given where we are, let's just stick to Romans. Let's see what God is saying in the setting. We can justify that to some extent by saying that the original authors, hearers, the Romans, wouldn't have had the rest of the Pauline letters or the rest of the New Testament. They would have had the Old Testament. So it's legitimate, I think, to say the original hearers in Rome would have had the Old Testament. They would not have had the rest of the New Testament. So if I was a Roman citizen in the church in Rome receiving Paul's letter, what would I have made of it? I'd have Romans and the Old Testament. And that gives me the information I need to understand Paul's purpose for them. And we need to work with that in the first instance to understand God's purpose for them, Paul's purpose for them. When we come to us, sometimes the rest of the New Testament helps. But we need to use it with care. But again, let me give you an example of that. When you get to Romans 14, Paul says to the church there, when somebody comes along with differences, accept them, don't quarrel over the issues which don't matter. At that point, it's useful to know that Paul isn't covering all issues. There's one verse in Romans which suggests that Paul would make an exception for doctrine. But the place you see it most clearly is by going to Galatians and seeing that on an issue there, Paul gets very, very heated indeed. So he can't be meaning accept people and don't quarrel over anything. Some issues are worth quarreling over, others aren't. But I would use it late in the day and very sparingly, and mainly say, let's stick to Romans. Thank you, that's helpful. Any other questions? If not, let's have a coffee break. We're now past time, I'm sorry. Let's come back at 11 o'clock, if we can, promptly. Have lots and lots of coffee and come back at 11 o'clock.